Today, we're in the Arctic, where things are changing fast. And Gary Young on why Ivanka Trump appeared at the G20.
This is it, we're in the Arctic, we're in Svalbard. And it's glorious.
It's absolutely amazing.
Svalbard is a cluster of Norwegian islands in the Arctic Circle, and it's home to the most northerly town on Earth.
Look at this polar bear warning sign.
It is a landscape like none I had ever seen.
On the other side of the fjord, which is enormous, like the ranges of snowy mountains. A bit like a child, I think, with all this excitement.
Jonathan Watts is the global environment editor at The Guardian, and recently we travelled up together to see the island, because Svalbard is experiencing profound changes. You're about to spend some time with us on our journey, meeting the people on the front line of this change.
Up in the mountain there.
Very few people have witnessed this more than Raiden Henningsen, who moved here 54 years ago. Like the majority of the people on Svalbard, she lives in the main settlement, Longyearbyen. And when she moved here with her young family, this place was a thriving coal mining town.
The first years we came here, it was very cold.
She described how the island used to be and what's become of it now.
Around 25, 30 degrees minus.
Yeah, so cold.
It has changed. Yeah. It was especially ice on the fjord.
Raiden's view over the sea has altered dramatically since she arrived.
Before, when the light came back in January or February, then you looked out on the sea and ice everywhere and seals laying on these black spots everywhere.
So out of this window, we'd have been able to see everywhere. Loads of seals.
Yeah, everywhere. Now it's not ice at all, only water. No, I don't like it.
Temperatures around the world have risen, on average, by about 1 degree Celsius since the start of the industrial era. In the Arctic, the change is happening at twice the speed. And within the Arctic, there are hot spots.
This place is a canary in the mine when it comes to the climate emergency.
And the hottest of the hot spots is this snowy paradise we're in.
It is warming 5 times faster than the global average. From The Guardian, I'm India Rakesson. Today in Focus, what is life like in Svalbard, the fastest heating place on Earth?
So, living underneath this mountain, you learn to kind of check the temperature and see what kind of snow is coming and the temperature of the day the snow falls. So, if we have had a very cold period and you know there is a layer of ice on top of the snow and then you get like 15 centimeters of new snow, you know you have to pack your bag because it might not be safe.
Lena is a hotel receptionist on the island. She's been here on and off for 11 years. She loves it.
Hopefully, I don't have to move again. I really like this place.
But in the past year, she's had to leave her home 4 times because of the new and growing threat of avalanches. In 2015, the town saw the most devastating of these avalanches.
Well, it was late, so people were sleeping. And it moved 2 houses quite far distance, actually, and a lot of snow even came through the houses. Yeah, people lost their lives and everybody was digging and trying to get the people out. And yeah.
And this was only the beginning. It was clear that this was becoming more frequent. The local government had to act and built defences up the mountain, but many houses just couldn't be protected. Instead, they had to be evacuated and soon they will be torn down.
So now it's closed off for humans.
Before she was last moved, she lived at number 222, where there have not only been avalanches, but also landslides. Lena takes us briefly inside. It's eerie. What was once home to dozens of people has been completely abandoned.
Yeah, they made this mark after they checked the house that it's empty.
There's a big black X on the front of the door.
Yeah.
This view, this is where I had my breakfast and my coffee and...
Oh, wow. It's weird being back, actually. Kind of gives you the chills.
If you stand in Lena's old living room, you can see evidence of this problem right across the valley. On the other side, you can see the white crosses of the cemetery, which now needs to be moved because of landslides, and the kindergarten, which is already closed because of the danger. As things started to change, the Norwegian government needed to understand the scale of what they were now dealing with. So they commissioned 12 scientific institutions to look at the changes and the impact they would have. And the details that came back in February this year were deeply alarming.
First thought that hit me when that report was presented was, this is something we can't handle. My second thought is, okay, this is the hard and brutal truth. We have to deal with it.
Morten Wediger is the head of the Environment Protection Department in the governor's office. He was in the room when the report, called the Svalbard 2100 report, was first presented.
It was a very quiet room. When the graphs were presented, when you saw how it has been, because this is climate change that's not only going to happen, it has already happened, and we're living in the middle of it.
The findings said that the island had already warmed by 4 degrees and could, just in a business-as-usual scenario, reach 10 degrees in the next 80 years.
Where are we heading? I think we can go up here.
Morten takes us up a hill to have a look over the town.
I came here in January 1996 for the first time, 20 years old, and it was pitch dark and I had no idea what I was doing. It's a very different kind of living, kind of life. And some people are not cut out for this.
The view is a contrast of wild, barren landscape and heavy industry.
It's a pity about this diesel tanks that sort of spoils the view, but again, it's important to remember where we are in the Arctic. We need energy supply.
Not only is Svalbard having to adapt to the fallout of the climate crisis, it also has to find a way of becoming sustainable itself, because the town here is currently run on coal and diesel.
So you can actually hear that power plant kind of chugging away, can't you?
Yes, you can hear the power plant, and you can also hear the noise from the harbour as well. But back in the old days, that ship couldn't be here because of the ice. So we are now looking out the fjord, a fjord with water on the surface. There's no ice on the fjord. That was unthinkable 20 years ago. At this time of year, it was usually covered with ice. This is the new normal.
What does it mean, having no ice here?
Well, for one thing, for the community, it means that you can actually have boats coming in here for the whole year. So from the economic point of view, it's a good thing. But for the wildlife, for the seals that were supposed to breed on this ice, for the polar bears who were supposed to hunt for these seals and live on this ice, it's a disaster.
And other changes, you mentioned that now the type of fish you're getting in the fjord and around these waters is also changing.
Well, we have seen species like cod, Atlantic cod, mackerel, which is more a southern species southern in Norwegian terms anyway, which is good fish for food. Whereas the original fish that used to dominate here was what we call the Arctic cod. So the ecosystem is changing in the marine environment.
The changes that people witness don't just mean more logistical problems. It's very clear from speaking to people that they have a deep psychological impact too.
This is changes on such a huge scale that you sometimes feel, well, how can I handle this? How can I deal with this? What can I do? Little me in this big picture. And to realize that, well, I can't actually. That's quite tough.
Although it feels like an overwhelming challenge, hundreds of scientists work on the island assessing the changes. Because despite sometimes looking like a barren wilderness, Svalbard is an island teeming with wildlife. And not just the whales, seals, walruses and polar bears it is so famous for.
sort of seeing a different Svalbard today, aren't we, with the clouds and...
Vanessa Patusi, a scientist we met on a boat trip taking tourists to see the island's glaciers, Hello. Is looking at something much smaller, but just as significant.
So my research is in sea ice ecology. Yeah, I look at the animals that live inside of sea ice.
Vanessa, who's wearing the white thick knit jumper that seems to be almost a uniform around here, is passionate about the island and the tiny subjects of her work.
We're mainly talking about marine worms, crustaceans, copepods. I guess a copepod is, you could think of it like an oval that is filled with fat and swims. I think that's like the easiest description.
Marine sausage, like a source of food.
Yeah. So I always think of it as the fast food of the Arctic. It's like if a whale or a bird or a fish wants to go to McDonald's, it eats a copepod.
So pretty important then?
Very important, yes. In a way, if the top changes, so like if we see changes in the polar bear or other marine mammals, it is most likely occurring because something is changing on the bottom.
Sea ice across the whole Arctic is melting at a rate of 10,000 tons per second. As the ice melts and the water's warm, these copepods, these marine sausages, are in increasing danger. But it's not just the atmospheric heat that's causing the decline of this habitat. The natural cooling system of Atlantic currents is changing as the Arctic Ocean warms.
We have some Atlantic water flowing past the west coast.
And this is making way for ever warmer currents from the Gulf of Mexico.
And I mean, this water is, relatively speaking, it's warm, 3 to 4 degrees. But that's already warm enough, even when it's mixing with Arctic water, to stop sea ice from forming.
It's kind of like a sandwich effect then of warming, like it's being warmed from the top and the bottom.
Yeah, exactly. But I think in a way it'd be so weird if the ice over the Arctic Ocean just melted. Trying to comprehend that is it's difficult.
It's not just the sea ice that's disappearing. The glaciers that cover 60% of Svalbard are retreating.
Where did everybody go? Oh my God, it's like the Marie Celeste. Oh, we're here. Oh, I see. Right. Oh my God, there's a glacier. Right, hang on. Okay, up to the top deck. Wow, that is absolutely beautiful.
Cabin further out, and that's where the glacier used to reach. But yeah, it's gone down a lot.
Just tell me what we're looking at, Kelsey.
Oh, okay, so this is Esmark Bren, Esmark Glacier. Depending on the amount of light or the clouds in the sky, the color kind of changes, which is, yeah, it's special. So this one goes back about 15 kilometers. And the front wall is about 50 to 60 meters high.
As I stepped onto the deck, I heard you telling everybody that this is shrinking.
Yeah, so out of all of the glaciers on Svalbard, a big percentage of them, at least half, are decreasing in size. So I know the summers here have been getting a bit warmer each time.
John, yeah. A glacier.
Isn't it amazing? Oh, yeah. Wall of ice, looks like something out of Game of Thrones or Narnia, or it's an incredible sight. And also kind of sobering to think it was actually several hundred meters further out to sea not that long ago.
But you can see it has a really powerful impact on people.
Yeah, I suppose we just don't get to see ice as such a dominant presence. It feels like it's another planet, but actually this is part of our home and does a really important job for the rest of the planet in kind of regulating the climate.
The ice up here reflects the sun. It actively keeps our world cool. It's impressive and beautiful. But the more time you spend here, the more it feels like every inch is slipping away. One of our final stops is on board a different tourist attraction, a husky sled, driven by Auden Salter. a tall bearded Norwegian who's just had a baby called Thor. He's a trained Arctic guide and runs a husky yard of over 100 dogs. Much of their livelihood depends on the snow in this fast-changing and fragile land. He takes John and I, wrapped up to our eyeballs, speeding out through the valley.
Just losing this would be... I'm not sure how it's going to be, but it's going to break my heart to not be able to go out like this with the dogs, the snow. In the summer, we have wheels, carts with wheels that we go dog mushing on. It's fun, but it's not the same.
You guys come here.
Are you seeing a change in when you have to change to wheels because of the snow?
Yeah, we see that the snow comes later in the year and then goes earlier in the year.
As the temperature rises quickly in the Arctic, many see opportunities for money in the changing landscape. Less sea ice opens up shipping channels. It opens the way for oil exploration. And here on Svalbard, more visitors can come. Thousands a day sometimes arrive on cruise ships. Good for the tourism industry, but risky for the island itself.
Because it's very, very vulnerable up here. So in the summer, for example, if you walk in a marsh and you put down your foot, you ruin an ecosystem that has spent decades of just growing, and it's ruined. It goes slower. Things need more time to recover from the impact that we do. I know most people in the city here are concerned about the changes. We're losing our way of living.
It's clear that Longyearbyen has had to adapt fast. But ever since the Svalbard 2100 report landed, there's been a new urgency to discussions of what needs to be done and if it can be done quick enough. Walking up through the town on our last night in Svalbard, the future of this place really was all that we could think about.
What? It's probably really annoying every time I ask you this, because I ask you it so many times. Is enough going to be done?
Enough for Svalbard? Enough for the planet? Enough for who?
All of it. Anything. Is something, will something be done?
There won't be enough to stop climate change and climate disruption. It's already started. But every little thing that is done slows the process. This is a community that we heard 10 years ago was almost in denial about climate change, because the focus back then was, can we open more coal mines? And now it's a community where people talk about climate change all the time. And so I think that sense of the issue forcing itself into people's minds because it becomes impossible to ignore is something that will happen to other places more and more. The sooner that happens elsewhere, the better.
Jonathan Watts has written a lot about our trip to Svalbard and even more about what's happening in the Arctic. You can follow all of his work at theguardian.com, where you can also see pictures of this amazing place. Coming up, why has there been so much derision over Ivanka Trump's presence at the G20? Now, on the weekend, a video was released by the French government of a group of world leaders deep in conversation at the G20. And on the edge of the circle, Donald Trump's daughter, Ivanka, is attempting to join in. There's been an outpouring of criticism over her presence at the summit. But what's actually the problem with her being there? Here's The Guardian's editor-at-large, Gary Young.
So there's a video which shows Ivanka Trump, Donald Trump's daughter, trying to kind of become involved in a conversation with Emmanuel Macron, Christine Lagarde, Theresa May.
As soon as you start talking about the economic aspect of it, though, yeah, a lot of people start.
And they are chit-chatting. I mean, if somebody could come in with some Ferrero Rocher, it's that kind of thing. It's a diplomatic event. And really the center of this is that Ivanka Trump is trying to insert herself into this conversation and failing quite miserably. The video was taken by the Elysee machine, the French presidential machine, which makes one think that it's quite aggressive trolling by France of America, because it shows her in a light that makes her look like she doesn't know anything and that she's kind of daft. No one's really listening to her, and she is, not to mix the metaphors too much, but she's a fish out of water and out of her depth. So the response to the video has largely been mocking and making the point that I fully understand, which is that, you know, she shouldn't be there, that she is there by dint of being the president's daughter, and that doesn't qualify you to be in a room with other world leaders. And I understand all of those comments. I'm a kind of fierce critic of Donald Trump. I think it's appalling the way that he has appointed his children and their partners to positions of authority. Obviously, it raises serious questions about democracy. What is this woman doing there? Those are all very legitimate concerns. But I would say only this, that to suggest that that room is some hallowed diplomatic room where great things are being discussed, we have to just take a minute. Theresa May is in that room. She's not that great. We know that. True, you can say that she was elected or that she has some kind of democratic mandate in a way that Ivanka does not. That's true. That matters, but I would argue that Christine Lagarde doesn't have any democratic mandate. She has a massive amount of power over large numbers of countries, but nobody elected her to that position. That room is full of people who have been guilty of kind of the most terrible crimes and murders, and so the notion that she is somehow polluting the room, I kind of find a bit laughable. That room already had a lot of people who'd done a lot of bad things in it before she came into it, and frankly, not a lot of them are the sharpest knives in the drawer. And so there is an awful lot of haughtiness around the notion that Ivanka Trump walks in the room and suddenly this room that was full of democratic mandates and decent people and smart people having higher level conversations is suddenly reduced. British people have to take a minute before you start talking about kind of the president's daughter and what qualifies her to do that. We have a queen. That's the head of our state, is a queen. So that's a very big glass house in which to throw stones. Americans who want to talk about the diminishing of America's kind of diplomatic reputation, well, you know, there's the Iraq war, there's Israel, there's a range of things that America has supported before Trump that would suggest that there wasn't a huge amount of diplomatic cachet coming out of America to start with. None of that should detract from the fact that she shouldn't have been in the room. But then what do we make of that room and what do we make of her in it? They're two separate questions.
That's all for today. My thanks to Gary Young, to Jonathan Watts, and all the people that we met on Svalbard. Today's episode was produced by me and by Zoe Gilber. The sound design was by Eloise Stevens, and the executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.